Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. In a reporter roundtable, the team is joined by Michigan politics reporter Joey Cappelletti of the Associated Press to discuss the recent state GOP nominating convention, where past President Donald Trump won all of the available delegates. They also talk about what presidential primary stories they're still thinking about as the state and voters move on. Additionally, Democratic State Representatives Mike McFaul and Jason Morgan describe why they decided to launch a legislative public transit caucus near the end of February. The two want to zoom in on how improving public transit options throughout the state could drive economic development and expand Michigan's talent pool. Finally, longtime campaign finance expert Bob LeBrant details why he believes the Attorney General can add criminal conspiracy and aiding and abetting charges to the charges she announced in relation to Unlock Michigan and an alleged dark money scheme. Now here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, politics reporter Maggie George, and joining for the second segment, House reporter Danielle James.
Thank you so much, Jeff Smith, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast, which will be a stacked episode with segments ranging from a dark money chat to bike share comments and where they might fit in Michigan's public transit future. And I'm excited to talk about all of it. There is a lot going on. But because we have not done one of these in at least several hot minutes, we are beginning this week's episode with a MERS reporter roundtable featuring a journalism guest, Joey Cappelletti, the Michigan politics reporter for the Associated Press. Hey, Joey, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me on today.
No, thank you for joining. And obviously, we are here with our politics correspondent, Maggie George, and our editor, Kyle Malin. We are going to launch our conversation with a debrief on the March 2nd Michigan GOP nominating convention. So despite preemptive reporting that Saturday would consist of two dueling Michigan Republican Party conventions taking place on opposite sides of the state, a Michigan GOP nominating convention, one nominating convention, occurred in a single Grand Rapids location, where former President Donald Trump won nearly 98% of the vote among delegates, winning all 39 available delegates to be won at that convention. Now, I kind of want to kick off the question with you, Maggie. So it seems that this was an event where you saw members of the Christina Caramo faction. Obviously, she was not in Grand Rapids on Saturday, but you saw those individuals get kind of absorbed into the Pete Hoekstra faction so that they could participate in this event. What would you like our listeners to know in terms of the credentialing and what exactly was going on?
I wrote a story on Friday kind of diving into this, and as soon as I started to hear about this whole credentialing issue, I asked Kyle on our morning meeting. I was like, okay, well, if you miss the deadline, you miss the deadline, and what really do you have to complain about? And I, you know, did some digging and called some people up and realized that, like, it was a political conversation where, in the same way that, you know, when the January 6th meeting happened and there was kind of an argument going around of like, if people don't want Caramo to be removed, then why don't they go to the meeting and vote against her removal? Or the same thing, there was a meeting the following Saturday that Caramo hosted where she put her own removal vote on the agenda. The same conversation came around where it was like, okay, if the anti-Caramo faction wants to remove her, why don't they attend the meeting and show up and vote? But the answer to that question, why not go, is because it would give like validity to their meeting. Like you're recognizing it as an actual business conducting meeting when you want to make the argument that whatever they do at that meeting is not actually in order and not valid. So it was the same thing where the credentialing deadline originally was before the Grand Rapids judge's decision came out. So there were county chairs who didn't want to give their credential report to both Caramo and Hoekstra or like their administrations because they feared that it would make it look like they're recognizing one chair over the other, especially if it's one that they don't recognize as the chair. They didn't want there to be an argument of like, okay, well, if you don't believe that Hoekstra is the chair, then why are you giving him your credential report? And another element of it too that I heard from Dan Bonamy, who is a county chair, was he heard from one of a member of his county party that they threatened legal action against him. And I don't know, like, for providing information to Hoekstra's administration, which I don't really know if that would have you know, if that would stand. But, you know, if you're a county chair, you're kind of sitting there wondering, like, okay, what do I do? So some county chairs gave their credentialing reports to both parties, and some gave them to only one. And if you only gave it to Karamo's faction, there were several counties where that wasn't honored in Hoekstra's convention. That led to, in the first district, several people were waiting in the hallway and their peers voted against letting them into the first district caucus. And that was kind of that. They voted not to let them in, and then they voted to accept the credential report. And that's kind of how they spent the rest of their day. I was, you know, talking to the media and spending time in the convention room talking to other people, but they weren't able to vote.
Yeah, I thought Saturday was a great microcosm kind of the Michigan Republican Party, which was going into it, everyone knew that Trump was going to get 39 of the 39 delegates at play, which he obviously did, got 98% of the vote. But while all Michigan Republicans, you know, in the party at least, seem united on that front, there still is all this division going into it. I mean, holding the vote Saturday, we had two counties who eventually voted 100%, or not both of them, one of them voted 100% for Trump, who took nearly 4.5 hours to do that. You know, they couldn't get the agenda approved, they couldn't get credentials figured out. And I think that's a great microcosm of the party, and some that they have this ultimate goal of reelecting Trump, but there just seems to be so much chaos underneath that. And I think that gets a little bit to the larger question, which I've asked the new chair Hoekstra multiple times, which is, you know, he said on Saturday, we're all focused on winning in November. But I don't know if that is the case with everyone in the party. You know, if you go around and you talk to some of these precinct delegates, the goal for some of them is to get, you know, what they call rhinos out of the party. It's to get, you know, the establishment out of the party. And so I think that that's kind of one of the things that emerged from this conference for me was, can Hoekstra pull all of these factions together? Because while Saturday was a relative success, as we said, there was still almost, you know, 5 hours of just getting one vote on the president. I think that was kind of the larger theme a little bit.
So just to confirm, while this wasn't a situation where there were two different factions hosting different conventions under a single roof, it was very much a sort of merging of the two. You wouldn't say that this was a kumbaya moment by any means, correct?
I think because of the credentialing issue, it was not, you know, super peaceful, but there definitely were people who came together and recognized, like, all right, if this is the convention, you know, I want my voice to be heard. And if I'm credentialed, I'm going to go. Yeah, they ended up not doing the dueling conventions, the one in Detroit and one in Grand Rapids. But that doesn't mean that everybody was pleased to be there and happy to be operating under Hoekstra.
I mean, it was kind of a return to the normal. You had congressional candidates walking around. You had state lawmakers walking around, which for the party, a lot of those peoples have really avoided the party for the past year. And while I don't know if everyone, you know, you did have kind of this quote unquote establishment and then grassroots, it was still coming together under one roof. I think there was still kind of this, you know, Pete Hoekstra referred to it as the launching of this new version of the party. And I do think in a lot of aspects, it was that.
I've been just kind of curious about the impact of it all on the greater election. I mean, the fact that the Michigan Republican Party isn't going to be relevant in order to spend money, but it seems like DC is taking care of the U.S. Senate campaign, or they will, presuming it's Rogers. And it seems like Donald Trump is going to take care of Donald Trump, as he always does. And the congressional folks in DC are going to take care of the congressional folks. And Rick Snyder and his plan are going to take care of the state house people. So it doesn't really feel to me like while we're having like this internal debate about what the party should look like and who's pure and who's a globalist and who's a rhino and who's whatever, that in the broader scheme of things, that it's not going to really matter a heck of a lot.
Can I push back, I guess, maybe a little bit on that?
Please.
Well, Kyle,
please.
I do agree with you that, you know, there've been these vehicles kind of set up outside of the party to handle some of this stuff. You have on the other side a Democratic Party who has one of the best Democratic parties as far as, you know, functioning in this country almost. You know, they're very well put together. Anything that happens, they send out a release right away, kind of pushing back. You have, you know, Joe Biden's team has set up very solid statewide team already in the state. So I do agree that, you know, Trump and, you know, Rogers or whoever the Senate candidate is can kind of operate outside of this party. Bobby Shostak said that in the heyday in 2012, you know, the party was fundraising almost $30 million a cycle. I mean, Hoekstra has 8 months maybe to set something like that up. But I do think there's a lot of, you know, whether it be door knocking or all of these things that are kind of just left without, you know, that, that a presidential candidate can't really set up in the state without a state party.
What is something you witnessed at the Grand Rapids Convention that you weren't able to include in your Saturday stories because of deadline constraints? What is an experience you had, a conversation you had, something that you noticed that you're like, oh man, this would be an interesting story, but I can't plop it in?
I can go for that one first. I don't know if it was deadline constraints. I think it was maybe a little bit of running between 13 different rooms trying to 13 different rooms with different congressional districts and trying to see what was going on with the voting. I think for me, one of the bigger themes of the convention that I would have liked to be able to report on more is the disconnect between the Michigan Republican Party and Michigan Republican voters. Because if you want to take, for instance, the Michigan 4th congressional district, which includes Ottawa County, Ottawa County voted almost 35% for Nikki Haley in the primary. But then the 4th congressional district results show that I think Haley won about 5% of the vote. And so there's this, you know, you have the party overall voting 98% for Donald Trump, but in the primary you had much different, you know, almost 30% for Nikki Haley. And I really would have liked to go to kind of these convention or these different congressional districts, see what they were voting versus kind of the overall, what the primary results were, and kind of talk to people to really see, you know, where, I don't know if it's maybe a disconnect, but there's just a divide of this base versus the overall party.
I would also say because there were remote caucuses for the 1st and 4th districts, it would have been interesting to be able to maybe have somebody there reporting on what was going on there, or just develop that story more, just to show, wow, this is what was happening in the 1st district or the 4th district in Grand Rapids. This is what they were doing in the 1st district had a different caucus in Houghton Lake, and the 4th had one in Battle Creek. So it would have been interesting to, you know, be able to have some more information go into my story from the people that were at those caucuses.
And I know this question was asked of Chair Hoekstra after the convention, but I think the more long-running story here is the degree to which Karamo's folks are participating and cooperating with Hoekstra in getting them bank accounts, getting them emails, getting them the stamp back, and actually acknowledging the judge's order and conceding that long-term that they're not going to be recognized as the state party, and to just go ahead and concede that point, or if there's going to have to be more legal challenges for them to get what they want. Is Karamo willing just to burn the house down on the way out the door, or is she going to go ahead and give the keys off? I think that's going to be kind of an ongoing story that we're going to have to continue to monitor.
I want to do a little bit of a speed round, because obviously last week there was a presidential primary in the state of Michigan, where we saw in the Republican presidential primary, Trump won 68.1%. And then in the Democratic primary, Joe Biden won 81.2% with a 13.2% uncommitted voter turnout in that Democratic primary. I guess why I would describe this question as a bit of a speed round is that I just want to know, what is kind of the quick thing that you were thinking about as a journalist following that presidential primary? What is kind of something that you picked up that you think is a story that could have some long-lasting influence?
I think, I mean, the overall storyline, obviously, as everyone's kind of reported, is that both Biden and Trump had major warning signs. You know, neither really came out of this primary, you know, with the home run. I think the main thing for me is, I mean, the uncommitted is obviously a huge story, but I think how poorly Trump, or I don't want to say poorly, but, you know, Haley's performance in some of these suburban counties, I think, is a real something that had a big impact on the 2020 election. And we're seeing kind of signs of it again for 2024. Specifically, as I mentioned before, Ottawa County voting almost 35% for Nikki Haley, I think, was a huge, just not something I would have expected and something I'd like to dive in more to. I wonder, you know, some of that vote, if that's a little bit of pushback on the local leadership over there, you know, kind of a rejection maybe of some of those politics. But the fact that Ottawa County voted almost, you know, 60% for Trump in 2016 and 2020, and then voted 35% for Nikki Haley, I think could be something that has a big impact on the 2024 election, and just kind of how maybe some more conservative, traditional Republicans kind of view this election.
I'll just say that for my point, I think it's hilarious. And I, maybe hilarious isn't the right word, but I find it interesting that Donald Trump continues to run as the anti-establishment candidate when he is the establishment of the Michigan Republican Party or the Republican Party in general. I mean, this isn't like 2016 when he was the outsider coming in. He is the insider, and he's been the insider now for now two cycles. For me, you know, the party rises and falls now based on what he does. So does he have the party's best interest in mind as he's going out and campaigning? Or is this just more about him trying to raise money to pay for his legal fees to try and fight back on his own bad behavior? And the fact is that the Republicans actually have an alternative. They have somebody who is a viable alternative who's running in these states. And by and large, Republicans are saying, no, we're okay. We're fine. We're fine with Trump. We're fine with his behavior, regardless of whether independents are okay with that or not. I find that very interesting. That was a big takeaway for me, that there was that the blind reaction to Republicans is just to go and vote for Trump, because it's almost like, you know, voting for, let's say, Bush in 2000 or 96 or whatever. It's like, you know, he's the establishment. We're just going to go in that direction. And at what point is Trump being in the establishment something that voters just get turned off from? And then on the Democratic side, I think that there's just this reflex to just go ahead and vote for Biden in kind of the same way. Everybody wants to be a part of a winner. And it's just like getting coffee in the morning, you know, or taking the dog out for a walk. It just becomes like a reflex. Like, you don't even really know why you're doing it. You're just doing it because it's what you're supposed to do. I don't think that there's any real critical thinking going on in the electorate at all. I don't think they're looking at, and maybe they haven't been, but I think more than ever, I don't think there's really a critical analysis of any candidate. Politics has just become kind of reflective or reactionary, and people just go ahead and vote based on what they kind of picked up something here and there, but they're supposed to go this particular way. I'm a Democrat. I'm supposed to vote for Biden, so that's what I'm going to do. And on the Republican side, I'm a Republican and everyone's voting for Trump, so that's what I'm going to do. And there's not any critical analysis about, oh, what's their position on this or that? Nobody's paying attention to that.
I would say, with this being kind of the first 9 days of consecutive early voting here in Michigan, I'm kind of going to zoom in on the policy and the budget making items that could surface from all of this. I'm a little bit curious to see how clerks are going to candidly speak about how these 9 days of early in-person consecutive voting, how did it go? You know, I am a Harrison Township resident and I did utilize the early voting days. And I think by the time I showed up on that Sunday, me and my little brother were the 21st and the 22nd to have showed up that day. And it was pretty much close to the end. I think we showed up around 3 p.m. before they closed at 4. So I'm a little bit curious, are you going to see some clerks speak out about wanting to tweak up the process, maybe allowing some more flexibility for different municipalities to consolidate that early voting space? Are they going to ask for some newer revamped appropriation demands in terms of funding that consecutive in-person voting? So those are some things that I'm thinking about. And also, Kyle, I know that we talked briefly about this, that you kind of have to be a little bit careful as a journalist about how much you're reading into these primary participation numbers, because you kind of had Joe Biden versus the uncommitted opposition that was majorly zoomed in on this past week. And then you had Nikki Haley versus Donald Trump that was majorly zoomed in on this past week. But I'm looking at some of our state's most competitive U.S. House districts that are up for re-election this year, that we're already kind of anticipating a lot of money to get poured into them, just a lot of political action. I think about the 8th Congressional District, including Flint and Grand Blanc, as well as Midland and Bay counties, where you had 58,713 Democratic voters, more than 75,130 Republican voters. You have the 10th Congressional District, now represented by John James, covering Macomb County, 57,500 Democratic voters and 86,841 Republican voters. I apologize for the number drops, but I'm a little bit curious. Is this going to push some of those both Democratic Republican candidates? How does this kind of influence their moderate game that you see people play in these competitive seats in the state of Michigan?
Yeah, I don't know how much of that there is. I do believe, though, that when you have what is viewed as a competitive election, people like to participate in a competitive election where they feel like their vote matters. And I think that with the Trump-Haley thing, I feel like Trump people wanted to, they felt like just in case it was competitive, they wanted to go ahead and put their vote in there. And if people were passionate about Nikki Haley, they wanted to put their vote out there. And you really had to, in order to participate in that Democratic one, you really had to really be dialed into the party and get kind of bought into the enthusiasm of all this early voting and showing a strong side of support for Biden. Or you had to feel very strongly that Biden was not the right choice for Democrats. You really had to feel strongly because for the passive Democratic voter, that primary meant nothing to you. And you had other things to do. Even though you had 9 days of early voting, you had 9 days to do other things that you wanted to do with your life. And it just didn't involve voting because it just really didn't matter. Whereas I think for Republicans, it mattered a little bit more. And so that's where I think you saw in the 8th Congressional, the 10th Congressional, and probably in the state House districts too, a little bit more Republican participation. But when it comes to the general, there will be a whole fleet of different issues and a whole fleet of different candidates and passions behind those candidates. So I would just really be hesitant to equate one to the other.
I think that's very valid, and I think that's very interesting, Kyle. But could one also make the case that this amplifies the concern of that passive Democratic voter? I think that Democrats are faced with a lot of concerns about turnout and lack of enthusiasm, especially with there not being that competitive and interesting and vibrant Democratic presidential primary. Is there a story to be told on passiveness among the Democratic base?
I think there is. No, that you're exactly right. Well, you put it that way, Sam. I think you're exactly right. And that's the number one concern, I think, of Democrats going into this election, that the Democrats aren't necessarily enthused about Joe Biden. They're just scared to hell of Donald Trump. And they got to regenerate that and get them excited. You know, I think the biggest news that's come out of the Democrats is Joe Biden on TikTok. And I know that sounds really stupid and goofy, but, you know, his little thing that he did on TikTok, I could see generating a little bit of comfort with Biden. I'm not going to say like full-fledged like excitement, but a little bit of comfort that there are people around him that are propping him up and making him look relevant in the year 2024 at a time when his best days are like 20, 30 years behind him. And so I think that they do have to worry about that. And I think that was part of the reason why you saw Lavora Barnes, you saw Gretchen Whitmer, you saw them out there really promoting a pro-Biden vote when it really didn't matter because they're trying to get that enthusiasm rolling as early as they can.
Kyle, I completely agree with you. I was, though, a little surprised at the number of people who turned out to vote for Biden in what was basically an uncontested primary. I mean, he only got 120,000 votes less than Trump, which was pretty high. I think on the flip side, though, I agree with everything, you know, you're saying about passiveness. And I think Detroit's turnout, which I'll credit Bridge Detroit for this because I pulled the data off from there. They only had a 12% turnout, which was almost, I think the statewide was 22 or 23%. And I think if you're going to talk about Democratic concerns, I mean, I think potentially more than the uncommitted vote is if Detroit just doesn't turn out to vote. That's the largest Democratic base in the state. You know, we've seen all of the concerns from some Black voters, you know, that the Democratic Party hasn't done, you know, hasn't supported us, whatever. And so I think if you just have Detroit deciding not to vote in 2024, that's going to have a massive impact. And while it is only a primary, that 12% number, which is half of what it was in 2020, is a big warning sign.
Now, we are near the end here, and this has been such a great conversation. But just to kind of wrap it up, and as we kind of dive into this new week here in Michigan politics, as a reporter, what is the top story that is on your mind on this Monday?
Since we started this conversation, the SCOTUS ruling on the Colorado decision to remove Trump from the ballot was unanimously stricken down. So I'm going to be, you know, looking at that. I don't know what wave that we'll have in Michigan, but definitely interesting. You know, I've already seen Justin Amash, who's running for U.S. Senate and is a former congressman. He's already commented on it. So I'm interested to see what people in Michigan have to say about it. Whether or not it's a story for here is a different conversation, but it is still interesting nonetheless.
I can, I'll go real fast, but I think, you know, it's kind of sticking on the primary. I'm really interested to see in some of these Super Tuesday states what, you know, if any support the uncommitted vote gets in these other places, because, you know, Michigan is obviously kind of the home of that you know, with the density of Arab Americans in Michigan. But if we see in places, you know, there's only a certain number of states where uncommitted is an option, Minnesota, Colorado. I just saw Georgia's doing a leave it blank campaign, which is a little bit different. But I think if uncommitted gets some momentum from the Super Tuesday, it's going to kind of, you know, Michigan is the center of that movement, I guess. And so I'm really interested to see if they do get more momentum, kind of what these next steps are, you know, and kind of going forward for that campaign.
You know, my thoughts are kind of a little bit more long term in that this primary that we just went through showed to me how early people are making up their minds these days. You know, Nikki Haley went on air and put up, what, $500,000 or something like that, a million, somewhere along there in Detroit and Grand Rapids right before the primary, like the day of. Well, shoot, pretty much everybody had already voted by that point, you know, so it was really kind of a waste of money. And you know, 30, 40 years ago, that would have been a good use of money. Today, it's a waste of money because people outside of the 9 days of early voting, which you mentioned, Sam, hardly anybody used, but they may use it at some point. What people are using, though, is mail-in absentee balloting. I mean, so that is being pushed and pushed and pushed. And basically, people are just being driven to not even participate on election day, but to go ahead and get their ballots early and mail it in. So what I'm looking at is how these campaigns are going to react. And they've got to get their name and face and everything out there a lot earlier. Instead of campaigning in October, right after Labor Day, you got to be like freaking hitting it like it's election day. And maybe even August, when a lot of folks are still on spring or on summer break, you know, maybe right when the kids are coming back to school, you know, kind of that, like that late August, we're going to like see a massive ramp up. I just think our campaign election cycle is just getting completely, totally shifted. And instead of it being like a crescendo working its way up, maybe what we're going to see is that it's going to ramp up in like July or something, and then kind of maybe taper down a little bit in October, November. And that's kind of like October, November is just more like a get out the vote and just push people to the polls, which is, to your point from earlier, Joey, where the state parties will have an impact. And if they have the ability to actually get out there and shove people out to the vote, the ballot boxes, which I would concede the Democrats are very good at doing.
I am thinking about Senate Republicans' immigration bills in Michigan. You saw last week they tried to attach their package that deals with outlawing sanctuary cities in Michigan, as well as raising penalties for fentanyl possession and distribution. We saw last week when Senate Democrats were voting on a bill that basically keeps local governments from going after milkweed as kind of a monarch butterfly conservation effort. You saw Republicans attempt to attach their immigration bills to that bill while voting on it. And while those amendments did fail, they also made a successful effort to put those amendment votes on the board and get a recorded vote. So I'm a little bit curious, are you going to see Republicans in the state legislature try that game again as they zoom in on this immigration package? Another thing I'm thinking of is economic development. You have Lou Glaser, the president of the Michigan Future Inc. He's been going to a lot of legislative committees talking about how to make communities more attractive to Gen Z residents, young people. I'm a little bit curious to see if we're going to see some significant reform packages surfacing dealing with changing Michigan's economic development plan. And I am done. Okay, how did I do, Kyle?
Yes, you did try very hard to keep it brief, Sam. You made a good conscious effort. I like it when you do that.
Okay, everybody, that is our MERS Monday Reporter Roundtable with our guest journalist, Joey Capoletti with the Associated Press. Thank you all so much for joining us. Around 15 years ago, more than two decades from today, a survey from the National Household Travel Survey found that among young people in the United States from 16 to 34 years old, vehicle miles traveled dropped by 23% from 2001 to 2009, falling from 10,300 to 7,900 miles per capita. Meanwhile, in the same time period, passenger miles traveled by 16 to 24-year-olds through public transit jumped by 40% per capita. And the Federal Highway Administration found that the presence of teenagers and young adults without a driver's license increased from 21% to 26%. Flash forward to 2023 in Michigan, when the governor's Growing Michigan Together Council, a body dedicated to exploring how Michigan can elevate its population growth, reported that the state has failed to build a robust transit system and that its public transit user rates sit in the bottom half of growing peer states and under national rates. Public transit was categorized by the body as something to help create, quote, thriving, resilient communities that are magnets for young talent, end quote. Today, we are joined by State Representative Jason Morgan, an Ann Arbor Democrat, and Hazel Park Democrat Rep. Mike McFall, who organized near the end of February an official legislative public transit caucus specifically focused on policy ideas and priorities to build up Michigan's public transit system. Hello, Representative McFall and Representative Morgan. How are you all doing today?
Morning. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Oso, Representative McFall, it's Oso your birthday today.
It is. It is a big 5-0.
Well, thank you so much for kicking off your birthday festivities with the MERS Monday podcast. But just to dive into questions here, I mean, Michigan's legislature's Public Transit Caucus hosted its first ever meeting on February 28th. Why did you two decide to launch this caucus? And what are some policy and or research goalposts you have set for yourselves?
One of the reasons that I was so interested in starting this caucus is because, you know, a lot of people in my district utilize public transit here in the Metro Detroit area. I represent part of the city. Part of my district is Detroit, but people in the suburbs also utilize it. I rode a while back when I was on city council. I went with one of the Transit Riders United activists. Him and I took a ride from Hazel Park down to Detroit all the way to downtown so I could get a better idea of how our system worked or didn't work. was a little more accurate. Where the weaknesses are in the system and what needs to be helped. That gave me a really good idea of where a lot of my constituents have to deal with every day. So I know how important this is to the people in my district.
I would support that and add, for me, this is just about practical good government for Michigan. If we want to grow our economy and grow our population, we absolutely have to expand access to transit. Some studies say 75% of millennials have said that it's important for a city to offer opportunities to live and work without relying on a car. Frankly, I think in Michigan, the best case scenario we're looking at in the near future is allowing a lot of households who maybe are a two-car household to reduce to being a one-car household or find other ways to get around without needing to spend money on car insurance and registration and fuel and all those things. For me, it's just a very practical need for our state. We can't attract jobs and people if we don't have the things that those folks want. And everyone below the age of 60 is saying they want cars. As somebody who's on the younger end of the legislative spectrum, I hear from a lot of young people, as does Rep. McFall, that they're curious and frustrated that we haven't done more on this issue in the last couple of decades. So I think now is the time. People want it. And I am really excited that we have a lot of support from our colleagues to look into this issue and try and expand support.
And obviously, you had your first meeting on February 28th. What was that room like? Who all was in it? What were the frequent conversations? When you kicked off that first caucus meeting, what was kind of the top idea that people wanted to chat about?
I don't know if there was one specific idea because we come from all across the state. So everybody has their ideas of what transit looks like in their area. One of the main things we wanted to do was get a broad idea of where everyone was at. I'm not a big fan of top down. You know, I want to make sure that we're getting everybody's input into where we're going. Him and I aren't directing everywhere where we're going, but we're all moving in that direction based on whatever it is in your area that works best. So the biggest thing that we were trying to do was get some ideas from people for direction from their areas, because I mean we have a broad group from across the state, bipartisan. So things look differently to different people in different areas when it comes to transit, whether that's light rail or buses. It was more of a starting point just to get an idea of where everyone was at.
we had a lot of really interested colleagues who were asking questions about a topic that maybe they hadn't had a lot of experience in. I've been working in this space for a number of years now, from back in my days as a county commissioner working with Metro Detroit on regional transit. And so I've been able to learn a lot about how the funding works, how the systems work. And so we had a lot of questions from colleagues all over the state wondering what the biggest needs are. And so as Mike said, we aren't just trying to push our ideas or push for one region of the state. We had colleagues from the Thumb, from Northern Michigan, all over the state that we really want to help support what their districts need as well. I think one of the unifying themes has been supporting our local buses throughout the state. We have transit providers at every part of the state of Michigan. So that's a pretty key theme that came from it. But I think initially learning more about transit and working together on that issue, identifying what those needs are for each part of our state, and then working together to support our colleagues and these priorities.
I know you both talked a little bit about, you know, people in your own districts using public transit and how it's working. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? And also, you know, what do you believe are the biggest barriers for people to utilize these options that we already have available, you know, things like buses?
I know from my district, like when I went on that tour with the Transit Riders United, he wanted me to see what it was actually like to ride. We took it down over to the transit center that's over at Woodward at 8 Mile. And as soon as my bus, the doors open, three people ran across all 8 lanes of Woodward to get to a bus on the other side. So one of the reasons he wanted me to go on this is because he wanted me to see where the issues are. One of the issues is timing when buses are coming through. Well, not everybody's going to be able to jump off a bus and run across all 8 lanes, and they shouldn't, just to catch the bus on the other side because of the timing issues. Some of the other issues that we've been having in this area are what they call ghost buses, where they're on the schedule, it says it's coming, and it never shows. That's primarily due to the staffing issues. You know, the things that people have to go through, we have to make sure that it's a reliable source of transportation. Otherwise, people aren't going to utilize it. You know, if I have to be to work at a certain time, I got to make sure I'm there that time every day.
Well, and that's the thing. People need transit to be reliable, frequent, accessible, and to go to the places that they need it to go. One of the challenges I've long seen in Michigan is that we fund transit just enough to exist, but in many cases, not well enough to actually be reliable enough for the people who need it. For a lot of us working in our jobs, if we're a few minutes late, it's not the end of the day. Heck, legislators are always late to things. But for the average person showing up to an hourly job, if you're 5-10 minutes late, or even 1 minute late in many cases, you could lose your job. And so a lot of people can't rely on transit currently. And we'd like to make it so that we're investing in these systems sufficiently enough that they're consistent, reliable, and something that people can count on. I think that is the most important piece. And the only way you do that is with consistent, reliable funding to support these investments.
I'm glad that you brought up funding. It seems that when people think about the transit future in Michigan, individuals want to talk about high-speed rail. They want to talk about trains. They want to talk about a subway that does not currently exist in our state. Now, I did some Google searches last night, and I saw that it can cost $3 million per mile to install a railroad track, and subway and light rail construction can reach $2.6 billion, billion of a B per mile, according to some calculations. Where is the money going to originate from?
Well, I want to say this. It costs, I believe, about $3.2 million to build a mile of highway as well. So we're spending millions, and in many cases, billions of dollars in transportation already. But I don't want to get us down a track of pitting car lanes versus public transit. Frankly, I'm excited about all investments in infrastructure. I think we need to fix our darn roads, and we have to invest in public transit so that people have alternatives. I think there are a lot of sources of revenue currently that are dedicated for transportation, whether that be roads or public transit in the state budget, that are actually going to the general fund. And so I think there are plenty of sources of finding little bits of money, a few million dollars here and there, to support some of these efforts. Listen, I have understood from my first year in state government that there's no one-size-fits-all solution to anything or one magic funding source. But what I've seen over the last few years is that there hasn't really been as much of an effort. So our goal is to pull together legislators who care about this, make sure that their needs are understood and their community's needs are understood, whether they be urban or rural, and that we're helping advance those things as much as we can, wherever those opportunities are.
Oh, I was going to say, I also think that we need to look at these things in a different way than just about, you know, the funding source. This is, it's also an economic development. It drives economic development. And, you know, if you want to be able to have a reliable pool of employees, we have to look at this differently. It's not just funding infrastructure. It's also funding economic development in the state. We often don't look at these things in that way. But if you want to open up your pool of employees to allow for the greater size or the greater pool of people to pick from, best talent, you have to be able to cast a wide net, and it really helps drive economic development throughout the state.
I think I have a follow-up question, and it is that the end game here with your caucus? Is your caucus's end game, is it to have high-speed rail, more train tracks, a subway system? Or do you think the early part of your caucus is going to be looking at how do we build up the systems we already have, like buses?
Well, so I first want to add what Rep. McFaul mentioned. A dollar invested in public transit brings back a five to one economic return. Public transit is absolutely a tool for economic development. And that is one of the keys that is important to think about. It's not just getting people where they want to go. It's actually growing our economy. We've invested billions in economic development in recent years. And I think those things are very important. I also believe that we could invest billions in public transit over the next decade. With that said, to your question there, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. So some parts of the state will rely on door-to-door, dial-a-ride type services. Some will be looking at bus rapid transit. Some will be looking at intercity connections with rail and increasing routes between Chicago and Detroit and expanding those routes outside of our state borders so that we can secure more federal funds to support rail in Michigan. And then the other piece is just making sure that we're prioritizing those things.
I'm curious, you know, if you can give us a sneak peek as to what some of that specific policy will look like, if there's anything that you have in the works in terms of bills you're looking to draft.
So I'd say there are short-term and long-term goals. What I understood from our meeting last week was that a lot of our members want to learn more about public transit, and I think they would be really supportive of some different efforts on the policy and funding side as they learn more. But I guess initially, there are some short-term goals of increasing support for our local bus operating funds, so local bus service providers across the state that include services to like senior programs and people with disabilities and all those things, it supports that work. And then looking at policy solutions to expand access to transit or to provide more options for supporting transit at the local level. So I'd say those are a couple of the initial things we'd be looking at. Mike, what would you add to that?
I'm not sure if there was much more to add to that, because I mean, initially, we don't want to try to bite off too much. We're trying to, you know, support a system that hasn't been well funded to begin with. So we want to make sure that we support what we already have and then build from there.
I guess to the specifics that you're talking about, Danielle, we have seen and identified a key funding area that has come up in almost every conversation with transit providers across the state. And that's local bus operating funds. We have state funds dedicated to support public transit in the budget. And they're actually $200 million from those funds that are just staying in the general fund. We always say that we want to fund transit as like a user fee type thing where it has to pay for itself through the tax revenue associated with transportation. Well, we have tax revenue associated with transportation that we're not using for transportation right now. So I think that's one of the early targets that we're looking at to say, hey, can we pull more of those funds to actually supporting transportation? They're paid for with auto-related dollars. Let's utilize those funds for what they're intended for. So that's kind of an early target that we're looking at, but we're going to talk to our members about it and look at introducing something around that issue soon.
While I was covering the appropriations process last year for the now fiscal year 2024 ongoing budget, the Senate Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee was exploring $100 million being dedicated to beginning the conversation on high-speed rail. That was reduced to $20 million in high-speed rail grants in the final product. Why do you think there was a holdup last year?
I mean, I would say we did make a pretty bold investment with $20 million that Senator McMurro spearheaded in the Senate. And I want to add, Senator McMurro has been incredibly helpful in this process and a huge champion of public transit as well. That $20 million has helped us apply for a federal grant in Southeast Michigan for over $160 million that would expand bus rapid transit in four major corridors in four of the counties in Southeast Michigan. So that would be a huge investment. I think the governor is looking at providing more dollars for federal matching funds, because that's the true key to public transit, is getting matching funds at the state level and then being able to pull down hundreds of millions in federal dollars to support this work so that we don't have to do it all on our own. I think that's so important. In terms of that larger number you're talking about, I think it's a long-term vision that's needed, because right now we're funding this project or that project, which is really important and we're going to keep doing. But we need to have a long-term vision of what we expect public transit to look like in Michigan so that we can always be looking at tying dollars to that vision.
I think another curiosity that I have is that as you view young people that are driving less, fewer of them are owning vehicles. You've seen a lot of utilization and dependency on rideshare programs such as Lyft and Uber. Do you think that that needs to be a part of the conversations that your caucus is having?
I'm not sure if that would be a part, but we plan on including a lot of different things. It isn't just going to be about buses. It isn't just about trains. We have like that last mile. You know, you have like bike share programs that are happening in Detroit, I know, and across the state. You have even scooters that are all over the city in Detroit. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of different mobility pieces to this. I know, but I'm not really sure if we're going to try to include vehicles or not. What are your thoughts, Jason?
I mean, I'm excited about any way we can get people where they need to go. I personally would love to see Mike McFaul riding a scooter down the road. But I think we have to be looking at all of those things, because young people are both the most passionate about public transit and in many cases, the most impatient about waiting for public transit. And so I would like to see all creative options as we look at different types of mobility and vehicles and things like that. I could see a real scenario where you have a bus getting you through the major corridors, but then some alternative option for that last mile type service. The other thing I want to add to that is some of the biggest challenges we have in Michigan are certainly support public transit, access to affordable housing, an aging population, so with more seniors throughout our state. Transit is tied to all of those things. That's the thing that I think will help with a lot of our rural colleagues who care about this issue as well, is they have seniors in their communities who cannot get to the doctor's office or to see their family or to get where they need to go because they can't drive anymore. And that might not mean a bus through rural Michigan where I grew up or through the middle of the UP, you know, where I went to college or anything like that. It is very likely a door-to-door type service. And whether we call them a rideshare or a dial-a-ride or whatever we might call them, they're all essentially that same concept of a direct service for a resident that is needed. So again, I go back to, there is no one-size-fits-all solution for transit throughout Michigan. And I think we need to be looking at all these creative solutions.
It seemed like, you know, you had quite a few people that were equally as excited as you two to jump on board the caucus and get started. Could you tell me a little bit more about, you know, the bipartisan support that you've seen and, you know, how many people you have involved and what we can expect for future meetings?
I don't remember what the last number is, Jason, do you? Is it 48? We have 40.
I believe it's 47. But I'm reviewing our list because we may have had a duplicate. So I'm going with 47. But we had some people sign up twice because they were so excited. And so as I looked through that list, I had to make sure we didn't have any duplicates in there. But no, I think the excitement has been just how many different issues that transportation touches. I've had folks in Washington County try and do a senior millage, which is an important endeavor. But a huge part of that was public transportation for seniors. And my answer is, let's do transportation. Let's do transportation for everyone. I think that's what we're hearing from our colleagues, is they're really excited about how they can get some more support for their areas. Also, fun fact, rural communities get a larger portion of funding for transit than urban communities. We give up to 50% for local buses in urban areas and up to 60% in rural areas, because the formula acknowledges that it's harder to provide transportation in these rural areas. So I'm thrilled that we have some excitement from across the state And our job is to maintain that excitement, help our members understand and learn what they want to learn, and then support their priorities as well as these overall state priorities.
I want to do a final speed round before we exit this interview. What would you say, and this doesn't have to be something that you are full on committing to, but what is your dream right now? What is something, your boldest transit idea that you would absolutely love to see come to fruition in Michigan?
Light rail. I think that would probably be what many people would say. So mine would probably be light rail. I'd also like to see something that goes all the way from downtown Detroit up to Pontiac and then from Pontiac to Lansing.
I would say a robust statewide bus system. It's a very practical goal.
Do you all have titles? Are you like the co-chairs now of this caucus, the founders of this caucus?
You know, the funny thing is there's no formal mechanism for caucuses. So we just said, we're going to create a caucus and we're going to co-chair it. So we are, but it turns out there's no mechanism otherwise. So we've just decided that we're the co-chairs and we're going to lead this caucus for as long as we can.
Self-appointed.
The transit emperors of Lansing. Everybody, that is State Representative Jason Morgan, a Ann Arbor Democrat, and the birthday representative, Representative Mike McFaul, a Hazel Park Democrat. Thank you all so much for talking to us about the new Public Transit Caucus of the Michigan Legislature.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Daniel.
Our Dark Money series, as I am trying to call it, of the podcast continues, as we are now joined by campaign finance expert Bob LeBrant, who filed the August 2020 complaint, along with elections attorney Mark Brewer, against 501c4s, Michigan Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility, and Michigan My Michigan. On February 21st, Attorney General Dana Nessel announced charges against two political operatives who allegedly used those 501c4s, which were connected to former Senate Majority Leader Republican Mike Shirkey, to participate in a, quote, dark money scheme, end quote, using the nonprofits to fund Unlock Michigan in 2020. Unlock Michigan, for those who don't remember, was the successful signature petition effort to eliminate the state's 1945 Riot Act, which the governor used to deploy her early COVID-19 pandemic stay home, stay safe orders until her utilization of the statute was deemed unconstitutional by the Michigan Supreme Court. Historically, the 501c4s raised around $150,000 annually, but in 2020, the accounts were able to provide 86% of the $1.86 million Unlock Michigan had obtained that year in contributions. Bob, just to kick off the conversation here, what were your initial thoughts and reactions to the charges that originated from your August 2020 complaint?
Well, I filed the complaint because I read a newspaper article that talked about mystery money funding the Unlock Michigan campaign. And as I delved into it, I saw since its formation in early June of 2020 until the closing date of that July 20th report, they had received like six contributions from Michigan Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility, totaling over about $660,000. It raised a question in my mind, if they had all that kind of money on hand, why did they dribble it out in, you know, 150 here, 50 here? Obviously, it raised the alarm in my mind that what they were doing is that they were not taking money out of the 501c4, but they were fundraising. And as my dollars came in, then they went out and basically ended up in Unlock Michigan because they didn't report who was the original source of that money. It all just was Michigan Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility.
And Bob, why did you get involved in this suit, though, when there has been other dark money groups that have given to ballot proposals? Like I'm thinking the 1630 Fund, they've basically bankrolled the entire Proposal 2 campaign that we have now, these new election reforms. Why not go after them as well?
Well, I'm retired. I only have so much resources. And as a result, I felt a closer kin to this particular ballot proposal because, you know, I'm almost 78 years old. And I thought, here we're going to basically try to repeal, you know, emergency powers of a governor to deal with a crisis. And it seemed to me that the way they were going about it was illegal. And so I filed the complaint.
Do you think that there should be other groups that explore this issue? I mean, this is obviously something that you feel passionate about. Is there a need for a watchdog or somebody to go after and flag groups that are going and funding ballot proposals where we don't know who the source funder is?
Well, I think you have to take a look at how our system is set up. Basically, the Secretary of State and her staff doesn't sit around every day and decide, I read this article in MERS. Let's go investigate them. Generally, they're a little more reactive and they wait for somebody to come forward with a complaint. Over my career, I've filed a lot of campaign finance complaints. Some succeeded and some failed. But for the most part, when we take a look at the Secretary of State, who has the responsibility to enforce the Michigan Campaign Finance Act, the Secretary of State, whether it was Candace Miller or Richard Austin or Terry Lynn Land or now Secretary Benson, they don't have any subpoena power. And as a result, you know, I could make an allegation, but unless I can somehow find documentation, they're inclined basically not to proceed. And what was, I think, unique about this particular circumstance that occurred on February 21st with the news conference is that, you know, the Secretary of State had made a criminal referral of this matter over to the Attorney General. The Attorney General has all the tools in her toolbox to do a thorough investigation. And, you know, we have an 11-page affidavit that was put together by the chief investigator on this matter, which I think gives a roadmap as to how this matter should proceed.
So what I'm hearing from you, Bob, is that our laws just in general are a little too lax when it comes to campaign finance, that there has to be some type of teeth in the law. There's got to be some type of oversight. And there has to be some type of repercussion to this type of dark money scheme that we saw in the case with these two 501c4s that we're talking about, the 1630 fund and all these other 501c4s and 527s that are sloshing around and funding our campaigns today.
Without a doubt. At the same time, let's take a look at the two most serious charges that were levied at that news conference. One was something you don't hear about a lot is uttering and publishing. Heather Lombardini filed an affidavit to my complaint, and in it, she said that, we had all that money on hand, and we didn't need to do any fundraising. Now, once the Attorney General's office got an investigative subpoena from the court and went in and, you know, seized records and looked at emails and looked at bank deposits, and other documentation that proved false in about 1 second. In addition, Sandy Baxter, you know, was called in for an interview. She was read her Miranda rights and asked a number of questions. And at the end of the interview was told, now, do you want to go back and amend anything you've just presented? And she said no. She got charged with a 15-year felony of perjury. Now, both perjury and uttering and publishing are found not in the Michigan campaign finance law, but it's found in the penal code of the state of Michigan. Because we have a limited amount of time, I would like to at least lay out that there are a number of other things in the Michigan penal code that I think the attorney general ought to pursue as it relates to the, I think, at least 85 78 contributors that had their money funneled through a 501c4 and ended up in Unlock Michigan. And that's criminal conspiracy. Criminal conspiracy is where a person conspires together with one or more other persons to commit an offense prohibited by law. Well, that's a felony. And I think because they've got all these checks, copies of all of these checks, the next step is to basically call in these people who cut the check. You know, they're corporations, they're associations. And I think they need to be asked, why did you make this contribution, you know, to Michigan Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility or Michigan by Michigan? And they're probably going to find that Mike Shirky called them up or Mike Shirky sent them an email asking them to contribute and have the check made payable to one of these two undisclosed 501c4s. So criminal conspiracy, I think, is the next step. Another step is just the old aiding and abetting statute that's in the Michigan Criminal Procedures Act. So with aiding and abetting, with criminal conspiracy, with perjury, and with uttering and publishing, these are not necessarily provisions in the Michigan campaign finance law, but are an effective tool for the attorney general to pursue.
Now that you've said this, Bob, do you personally think that these charges are weak? Do you think that this is a weak slate?
No, I think the affidavit from the investigator is devastating, particularly to Mike Shirky. You've got, you know, language in here of him, you know, sending emails and calling out people and telling them to support Unlock Michigan, but at the same time he's also advising them that you want to, you know, put that money through to Michigan My Michigan or Michigan Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility, so that will remain anonymous.
But he wasn't charged, Bob. I mean, Mike Shirky wasn't charged.
Well, he wasn't charged for a violation of Section 24 or Section 34 of the Michigan campaign finance law that required them to form a ballot question committee. Heather was charged with that, not Mike Shirky. Mike Shirky, I think, has great exposure, particularly in this whole area of aiding and abetting, and also in the area of criminal conspiracy.
It seems that another part of the observation here of how did this happen, it was that lobbyists didn't like the stay home, stay safe orders. So they wanted to fund something like Unlock Michigan, but they didn't want to upset the governor. So they used this way so that they could remain anonymous. Now, I think my question for you is...
I agree 100%.
Well, I'm just making an observation.
Well, I think in essence, what we have here is we have basically people that couldn't say no to Mike Shirky, or felt they couldn't say no to Mike Shirky. At the same time, they wanted to basically hide their support of Unlock Michigan, you know, through the funneling of these contributions to these 501c4 organizations, not to upset the governor. There's one group I want to give a shout out to, because they actually played the game correctly. Associated Builders and Contractors gave, I think, $250,000 checks to Unlock Michigan. And so they went out there and said, hey, we don't like the closure of Michigan through these executive orders. And they backed it up with making direct contributions to Unlock Michigan to fund the petition drive to repeal that 1945 Gubernatorial Emergency Powers Act. They're the only group, association or corporation, that shows up, okay, on the disclosure forms of Unlock Michigan. And so I think they deserve credit. And all these other people, frankly, were almost sniveling cowards.
So when you filed the complaint, what did you want to be the message that the lobbying community ultimately receives here?
I filed the complaint because I wanted to get to the bottom of who is the actual contributor to Unlock Michigan, not just having that go, you know, put into one of these 501c4s and have that remain anonymous. I think the whole purpose of the Michigan campaign finance law is disclosure. Who makes contributions and what expenditures are made.
Do you think that the state needs to find a way to regulate these 501c4s, that there is less of an anonymous nature, at least when it comes to state ballot questions and state candidates?
You know, I think our campaign finance law is like 47 years old. Okay. And when we started that law, we had candidate committees, we had political action committees, we had office holder expense funds. Over the years, the whole landscape of political fundraising has changed. I remember testifying against abolishing OEFs, office holder expense funds, because I said all it's going to do is lead to legislators asking for a second bite at the fundraising apple. And they're going to do that through not through a disclosed office holder expense fund. They'll go out and form a 501c4 and not have to disclose that at all to the people of the state of Michigan.
What do you think could be the legislative policy response to these charges? What could be some antidotes when you think about updating our state's campaign finance law?
Well, I think the first thing, having labored through this thing, is to give the Secretary of State subpoena power. I mean, it didn't take the Attorney General very long to discover through their investigative subpoena that what Shirky and what the 501c4s were up to. And so if you gave the Secretary of State subpoena power, this wouldn't have to go to criminal referral. You know, the Secretary of State could have laid out the whole case for, you know, the violations under the Campaign Finance Act. I'm suggesting that, you know, you probably need to put some more teeth into the campaign finance law. But, you know, the Attorney General, if she decides to pursue criminal conspiracy and aiding and abetting, I think she's got a wonderful opportunity to clean up what I think has become a culture of non-disclosure that operates here in Lansing.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where do you rank when it comes to believing these charges will actually go to trial?
I'm not going to speculate. If the Attorney General decides that she's going to be aggressive about this, and she looks at her legacy and says, okay, if I have the opportunity to clean up this dark money mess that we have, that she has railed against, that Secretary Benson has railed against, and previous secretaries of state have railed against, I think this thing can proceed. If, in fact, she decides to punt, then they've missed a tremendous opportunity to change this culture of dark money.
A lot of people would say that this culture of dark money might never get resolved, because then everybody is subjected to the same penalties. Everyone's going to be looked at, regardless of if you're a Democrat or a Republican. Do you think there's some truth to that observation?
Well, I want to backtrack for a second and say, you know, one of the reasons that 501c4s have thrived is that that gives an opportunity for a donor to use corporate money and not that person's own personal discretionary income. Okay, people don't like to take money out of their own checkbook. People would prefer to have the company or the association make those expenditures. And I think, frankly, one thing that is worth looking at is, let's just make all contributions legal. And so a corporate contribution will no longer be a felony. You'll just report it. And the same thing with a direct contribution from labor unions. Let them do it. Just make sure that it's reported.
Now, everybody, that is longtime campaign finance expert Bob LeBrant. And just to confirm, formerly the legal counsel with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and now you are happily retired in Florida?
Well, I still live in Michigan. I still vote in Michigan. I just try to avoid the winters of Michigan. I understand it's been relatively mild this year. Congratulations for that, unless, you know, you like the snowmobile. Or you like to do ice fishing, which makes those resorts that cater to that, probably they've had a disastrous year.
On a lighter note, I'll just say that I was able to wear a sundress out last night, and it was fantastic.
Thank you for the invitation to speak on this. But let me just sum up. You know, the ball is in the Attorney General's court. She said, we're not going to try to charge Mike Shirky with a failure to file as a ballot question committee or failure to file campaign finance reports. That's a far cry from deciding that we're going to just basically shut down the investigation. I would hope that she basically pursues this and files additional charges, particularly against those people that didn't play the game, like Associated Builders and Contractors, that tried to hide their involvement and their financial support through funneling this money through these 501c4s.
Now, thank you so much, Bob LeBrant, for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you. Bye now.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Other news for this week involves Michigan State University Board of Trustees, which voted 6-2 in a special meeting following 10 p.m. on Sunday, March 3rd, to accept a report conducted by Washington, D.C.-based law firm Miller & Chevalier, stating that trustees Rima Vassar and Dennis Deno violated the board's ethics policies and bylaws, and that the governor should consider removing them. In the same evening, Trustee Vassar stepped down from her role as board chair. This is a story being covered by MERS News and our Capital Capsule newsletters. Now, to officially conclude today's episode, I would like to express my appreciation for today's guest, our journalist guest, Joey Capoletti of the Associated Press, State Rep Jason Morgan, an Ann Arbor Democrat, and Hazel Park Democratic State Rep Mike McFaul. I would also like to say thank you to longtime campaign finance expert Bob LeBrant for joining us on our final segment today. Moreover, thank you to the MERS team for hopping on today and helping me prepare this episode, editor Kyle Malin, politics reporter Maggie George, and House reporter Danielle James. Post-production of today's audio of today's podcast was conducted by Jeff Smith, who's affiliated with Mark Bayshore Audio out in Okemos, who is responsible for putting this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Schreiber.